Let's see. Yeah. You okay? That's good.
We're going to be talking about Kant today. We're making the transition from the ancient period to the modern period. Kant is every bit as influential when it comes to modern philosophical thought as Aristotle and Plato were with respect to ancient philosophical thought. Kant lived around the mid-1700s, and you know, this is when he was most active. And so we're talking about a period of time that's about 1,300 years after the fall of Rome. The modern world is already 200 years old by the time Kant reaches his maturity, especially if you have my conception of what the modern period is. You remember I've been arguing that the modern period begins with the great voyages of discovery. It begins around 1500. This inaugurates a new imperial period in which there's a global market, and then there are struggles between nation states for domination of the global market. Remember, the first nation states to achieve what political scientists call hegemony, you know, a dominant position in the world system, were Spain and Portugal, with Spain clearly the more powerful of those two nations. Those are the countries that sponsor most directly the voyages of discovery. They're the countries that establish large slave farm plantations in the Americas, and they're also the countries that mine gold and silver from the Americas and bring them back to Europe, to Spain, where they form great financial fortunes. They're also the countries that engage in the African slave trade, that begin transporting slaves from Africa to the New World. And lastly, they're the countries that begin the colonization of India and of Asia in general. Their hegemony lasts for about 100 years. And then they are successfully challenged by their own colony, namely Holland. Holland comes to a dominant position, in part because of its very important merchant and naval fleets. This enables Holland to dominate the seas. And in part also because of the fact that, and it's a related fact, that there is a very dynamic middle class that's beginning to accumulate wealth through mercantile activity. So Holland becomes dominant for about 100 years. We don't really think too much about this because Holland's such a small country. It's remarkable that they were able to control the global market for as long as they did. I think it's probably impossible now for a small country to do this because of changes in technology and also changes in warfare. But Holland was supreme for about 100 years, and then it began to lose power, and the two contenders that fought with one another over the succession to Holland were France and England. And that's really what, for example, the American Revolution was about from a global perspective. Now, from a local perspective, it had other meanings, but from a global perspective, the American Revolution was really a bone of contention in the battle between France and England. So you had France supporting the colonists because to get a breakaway from the British Empire meant a weakening of England and therefore a help to the French who were trying to control things globally. This was a period of bloody war. Nothing like the First World War or the Second World War. You know, the First World War, remember, 10 million people died, and in the Second World War, 100 million people died. But nonetheless, when the French and the British armies met one another on the battlefields of Europe and also even in the United States, the result was a great deal of death and turmoil and spilling of blood and so forth. Finally, that was put to an end with the British defeat of Napoleon in 1814. That sealed England's ascendancy. And then you had the British Empire as the globally hegemonic power. Right? The sun never sets on the British Empire. Wherever you are on the face of the earth, there is some British possession that's illuminated by the sun. This is what the famous saying means. And of course, India was known as the jewel in the crown of the British Empire, but there were colonies in Africa, colonies in the Caribbean, colonies in Asia, and so forth. Now, Kant came of age while the French and the British were fighting it out. And he died actually just before the British won the Battle of Waterloo and sealed the fate of France. So his period is a period of warfare. And this is a big issue for Kant, because for Kant, the widespread destruction that was occurring on the battlefields of Europe as a result of the competition between France and England created a moral dilemma. And Kant is going to argue in his work Perpetual Peace and in other writings, other related writings, that the primary moral obligation that people face is the obligation of abolishing war. He argues this because he's responding to something real that's going on, namely this the spilling of blood on a large scale as a result of this conflict. Kant is also reaching his maturity at a time when a cultural movement and also a political movement has taken root in Europe and the United States. And along with the widespread warfare that was going on between France and England, that movement also had a huge impact on Kant's philosophizing. And the movement I'm talking about is the movement that's known as the Enlightenment. Let me see if I got it. Oh, damn, I don't have one now.
Permanent marker.
Yeah, you have a permanent marker? I should use that just to get back at these bastards for not having a real blackboard in here.
Or a smart class.
You don't see a crazy marker there, do you? No. Well, in any event, I won't be able to write on the board then. In any event, the Enlightenment, the years that, these are tough calls to make, but the years in which the Enlightenment is a living reality go from about 1730 to about 1780. Precisely the years, by the way, of the struggle between France and England. This is interesting because the two primary outposts of Enlightenment thought are France and the United Kingdom. Not England so much, but Scotland, which is a part of the United Kingdom. Hume is a major Enlightenment figure. So is Adam Smith. So is Adam Ferguson. There are a number of significant Scottish Enlightenment figures. And in France, the Enlightenment figures are even more famous. Voltaire, Diderot, the writers of the Encyclopedia. The first encyclopedia is published by the Enlightenment movement in France during this period of time. And you can understand how this is related to the idea of the Enlightenment, because what an encyclopedia is supposed to do is to place knowledge into the hands of ordinary people. And so several of the key Enlightenment intellectuals were involved in the project of creating an encyclopedia, which they did. There were Enlightenment figures who were literary geniuses like Voltaire. There were Enlightenment philosophers like David Hume. There were scientists who were associated with the Enlightenment, and so on. And the way I think of the Enlightenment, I think it's probably the best way to think of it, is to conceive of it as the second birth of the modern world. There was a first birth. There was a birth that preceded the Enlightenment, and that's what's known as the Renaissance. Renaissance actually means rebirth. The Renaissance figures, the key figures of the Renaissance, we're talking about a period of time now that spans from about 1350, I'd say from about 1400 to about 1600. The Renaissance, of course, includes the great productivity of visual artists in Florence and in Venice, Michelangelo and Da Vinci and Raphael and so forth. These are all Renaissance painters, but there are also great Renaissance philosophers, great Renaissance political theorists. Machiavelli was a Renaissance political theorist and so forth. And what the Renaissance signified was, literally it means rebirth, and what the idea was behind it was that Europe was being reborn after a long period of darkness. And the period of darkness for the Renaissance figures lasted from the fall of Rome until their own time. In other words, the period of darkness was that of the Middle Ages. Now, the Renaissance was called Renaissance, called rebirth, because what was being reborn, according to the main theorists of the Renaissance, was classical culture, the culture of Greece and the culture of Rome, but on a new foundation, on a more advanced foundation. And I think it's interesting that the modern period begins by harking back to the past. In other words, the modern world is born with an attempt to recreate the classical world, the world of ancient Greece and the world of ancient Rome. And throughout the Renaissance, there is a kind of mixture of the new and the old. And so you think about, for example, the sculptures of Michelangelo. Well, they're different than Greek sculptures, but they're also based on Greek sculptures. You know, it's the classical Greek body that's the foundation of Michelangelo's sculptures, although the topic with Michelangelo is Christian rather than pagan. And there's a connection between the ancient works and what was then, you know, the modern works. And there was that kind of a mixture in philosophy as well. For example, many of the key Renaissance philosophers were also magicians. And by magician, I don't mean conjurer. I mean, they were people who believed that the classical tradition of Western magic was significant and philosophically significant. So Marsilio Ficino, Pico della Mirandola, were priests who were also magicians who wrote works on magic, as well as works on Platonic philosophy, as well as other writings, in the case of Ficino, medical writings, and so on. Yeah?
What did they write about magic?
For example, I think one of the most fascinating cases is Marsilio Ficino. Ficino was a priest, and a Catholic priest, of course. Italy is a Catholic country at this point, you know, and the Reformation is just starting to happen. But Italy is a Catholic country. And Ficino, like a lot of scholars and artists and intellectuals, was what we would now call bipolar. You know, the bipolar diagnostic category is now used for everybody and his sister, right? You're bipolar, you're bipolar, you know. I mean, there is such a thing as what's now referred to as bipolarity. It used to be referred to as manic depression, right? You know, I mean, genuine bipolarity is a cycle of very high periods of ice, right? And very low periods of depression. High periods of elation and low periods of depression that are outside of the control of the person who is in the grip of them. So it's not that you become depressed because you're betrayed by your best friend, right? You become depressed because it's your time in the cycle to become deeply depressed. And it's not that you become elated because something particularly good happens. You become elated because you are now in that portion of the cycle. Well, Ficino was bipolar in that sense. And many artists have been bipolar. Many intellectuals have been. Abraham Lincoln was bipolar, for example. A number of great American poets have been bipolar. It's a well-established reality that, for some reason, whatever the reason, you know, whether it's the fact that people who are attracted to intellectual and artistic careers also have a biological makeup that lends itself to bipolarity, or whether it's for some other reason. You know, nobody's really clear about that. There is that connection. And Ficino recognized it. In other words, he recognized in his own disorder a disorder that was prevalent among the artists and scholars of his period. So he worked on developing an antidote to depression in particular. And he was a medical doctor as well as a priest. But his therapy was magical in character. And the theory was, this was a theory that was really well entrenched in the Middle Ages and in the Renaissance, the theory was that depression was the result of the influence of the planet Saturn. And that scholars and artists in particular were likely to have been born with astrological charts with Saturn in the ascendancy. And there was actually a theory about how this worked. The notion was that people born under the influence of Saturn had a kind of dark and dry bile in their system. Now, bile is a byproduct of biological processes. It was one of the major, what medical science then called bodily humors. You know, blood is another one, right? But bile here is the one that's significant with respect to depression. And the production of a dry, dark bile under the influence of Saturn is what led to the physiological symptoms of depression. This is the theory. So, the idea that Ficino had was that it's necessary to counter the influence of Saturn by marshaling the power of other planets, which included, by the way, the moon and the sun, right? In other words, the word planet referred to all of the heavenly bodies with the exception of the so-called fixed stars at this period of the time. And there were three planets in particular that had influences contrary to Saturn. And they were the Sun, Venus, and Jupiter. You know, the Sun, obviously, is the morning star, right? And actually, there's something to this now. We know this. There's such a thing as seasonal depression, in which lack of sunlight contributes to depression in people. So the notion was you had to marshal the... And then, of course, Venus is the planet that is associated with the goddess of love. And Jupiter is the planet that's associated with the chief of the Olympian gods, you know, Zeus, or in Latin, Jupiter. And in each case, these planets represented a kind of buoyancy that could be channeled into people. So how do you channel the influence of those planets? Well, Ficino had gotten a hold of some texts. Ficino, by the way, was also the translator of Plato. When Plato's works became available to Northern Europe as a result of the Crusades, it was Ficino who translated them. Ficino was the head of the Platonic Academy that was reestablished in Florence. And he was a major figure, major philosopher. And yet he was also a magician. So the notion was that he got a hold of some texts that were actually Arab texts. One is called, important one is called the Picatrix. And in the Picatrix, there are prescriptions for creating talismans. Now, talismans are physical objects that are supposed to represent little, I don't know how to put it, concentrations of power that people can avail themselves of. So there were instructions for creating talismans in the Arab texts, and Ficino adapted this to his purposes. So by consulting the Arab texts, also by consulting some other Neoplatonic writings called the Corpus Hermeticum, which were supposed to have been produced by the god, the Egyptian god Thoth. It was widely believed that these texts that were coming into circulation at the same time as Plato's texts had been written by Hermes Trismegistus. Well, Trismegistus means thrice great. And the notion was that the Egyptian god Thoth had been born three times. And that Thoth was in fact, who was the scribe god, was in fact the figure Hermes Trismegistus. And those texts also had references to talismans. So Ficino created talismans, and the way he did it was he would take a piece of metal, and probably employ a gem carver to do this, or a metal carver. And we take the gem or the metal and bring it out under the planet at the particular time of the year when the planet was in the ascendancy. So the sun was easy, right? You could do this as the sun was rising. But you had to wait until Jupiter was in the right part of the sky or Venus in the right part of the sky to make your talismans of Jupiter and Venus. And then, by relying on the Arab texts, he would have embossed on the gem, carved on the gem or on the metal of the jewelry, an image. And the image would be an image of Venus, an image of Jupiter, or an image of the sun. And there were several such images that were described in the books that he was reading. And then, having made the talisman at the right time, the talisman was then imbued with the power of that planet. So the idea was that if you were depressed and you wore the correct talismans, this would channel the power of Venus, Jupiter, and the Sun, and counteract the influence of Saturn, which was responsible for your depression. And he did other things as well. He was a composer of music, and he composed hymns to Venus. This is a Catholic priest, by the way. Right? He composed hymns to Venus, Jupiter, and the Sun. And so one of the things that the patient would be asked to do is, you know, listen to those hymns or play them, if the patient could play a musical instrument. There were also prescriptions about how to dress. Some of the stuff seems like almost common sense. You know, in order to get the influence of the Sun, you want to spend a lot of time outdoors in the sun. And of course, if the depression is seasonal, we now know that that in fact does help, right? Well, Ficino developed all of these methods for chanting. You know, this is called astral magic. The source of the magic is the power of the stars. And he developed all these methods of astral magic, and he wrote a book called, it's called Three Books on Life, in which he describes the theory behind this. The interesting thing about Ficino is that there's a great Renaissance painting by Botticelli, and it's called Primavera. Right? Primavera in Italian means spring. And I'm sure you've seen it. It's a big panel painting, a fresco, I guess, with Venus in the center, and she's surrounded by flowers. It's springtime. You know, the earth has gone through its winter period and is being reborn.
Is she in an oyster?
No, that's also Botticelli. That's the other great painting of Venus by Botticelli. In this painting, Venus has a gown on, and she's in the forest, in a kind of clearing. And Hermes is on one side of her, and Hermes is stirring the clouds with his staff. And there are other figures, one of whom is being abducted, a woman who's being abducted by the north wind. And there's some other images in the painting. And it turns out that Ficino is the one who designed the painting. In other words, I mean, he wasn't a painter, but he laid out the elements that the painting was to have. He was commissioned by his sponsor, which Medici was it? Lorenzo de Medici. The Medici family was a wealthy family that patronized the artists and the philosophers of the time. And Lorenzo de Medici was the patron both of Ficino and of Botticelli. Lorenzo commissioned the painting to give as a gift to his nephew who was about to get married. And the painting was to hang in the bridal chamber, which is where it did hang. And there are scholars who believe that since Ficino was involved in drafting the elements of the painting was meant to function as a giant talisman. In other words, it was meant to bless the new married couple with happiness by channeling the influence of Venus, the planet Venus, through the painting, you know, into the bridal chamber. Botticelli is an interesting character because after Botticelli painted a number of paintings like this, including, you know, Venus Rising from the Sea, which is the one you're thinking of, Walker, he then became a kind of born-again Christian under the influence of what was then the equivalent of the Christian right. A right-wing Christian theorist, Catholic theorist. What the hell was his name? I'm blanking on it at the moment. But in any event, in his middle age, under the influence of his conversion or his reconversion, he burned a number of his canvases. And are you familiar with the expression bonfire of the vanities? Now, there's a film with that title based on a novel that was written by Tom Wolfe, kind of a critique of the stockbroker culture of the 1980s. But Bonfire of the Vanities was really originally the title for the act of burning his canvases, Botticelli's canvases. Well, you can see here that the Renaissance is the breakthrough to the modern world, but it's an odd breakthrough. It's a breakthrough in which priest doctors are developing magical, you know, magical remedies
for depression, and in which the great artists are being reconverted, and one of them is reconverted to a right-wing version of Christianity and then throws his paintings into the bonfire. That's the first birth of the modern period, and it's a mixture. It's a mixture of the old and the new. What happened with the Enlightenment, comes about 200 years later. And what happened with the Enlightenment is that you had a second birth. And this time, the birth was not mixed. There were references to Rome. You know, there's no doubt about it, and there were references to Greece as well. But Enlightenment culture was now fully adequate to a world that had changed dramatically in the 200 years that separates the Renaissance from the Enlightenment. And Kant is a key Enlightenment figure. Kant in Germany, there were others as well, Lessing and Herder in Germany, but Kant is really central. In Scotland, as we said, David Hume, Adam Smith, who wrote the Wealth of Nations, is probably the person who could be called the father of economics, right? And then in France, Voltaire, Diderot, Holbach, you know, a bunch of other people, the writers of the encyclopedia. And then in the United States, Jefferson, Franklin, Tom Paine. Tom Paine is British, but Tom Paine's pamphlet, Common Sense, more than anything else, inspired the colonists to break with England and was the immediate cause of the American Revolution. These were all key Enlightenment figures. Now, Kant wrote a treatise, very short actually, less than a page really, and he called it What is Enlightenment? What is Enlightenment? And the way he answers that question in this very short paper is by saying that enlightenment is the willingness and the courage to use your own reason. It's the willingness and the courage to use your own reason. This is associated with a view of the period that preceded the Enlightenment. The Middle Ages, but then also the remnants of the Middle Ages during the early modern period. What's the nature of culture and politics during that period of time? Well, for the Enlightenment theorists, there are really two things that define culture and politics prior to the Enlightenment. One is that politics is dominated by kings, and the second thing is that culture is dominated by priests. You have two dominant figures in the pre-Enlightenment period, priests and kings. Let's begin with kings, because I think it's easier to see what Kant is getting at least initially. Actually, it's pretty easy to see in both registers. There was a traditional medieval doctrine of the good king. A good king is different than a tyrant. A tyrant, if you are ruled by a tyrant, you have the right of resistance, up to and including the right to kill the tyrant. This is interesting. This was recognized by the Catholic Church, for example. A tyrannical ruler can legitimately be killed by his or her subjects. What distinguishes a tyrant from a good king is that a good king rules in the interests of his subjects, while a tyrant rules in his own interest. So a tyrant might send his subjects to war in order to enrich himself, for example. A good king would send his subjects to war in order to protect them from foreign armies. Just to give you an example here. So, the medieval idea was that what you want, of course, is good kings and not tyrants. And once again, what distinguishes the tyrant from the good king is that the good king is ruling in the interests of his subjects. But Kant points out the following. He says that the idea that a good king rules in the interests of his subjects is really the idea that it is legitimate to treat people, adults, like children. Because what's the model here? You know, what the model is that of the authority of the father over his children. See, the father has legitimate authority over his children, and I'm using the word father specifically because we're talking about really a patriarchal culture here. The father has authority over his children that is legitimate to the extent that the father makes decisions that are in the interests of his children. That's what defines a child as a child. A child is incapable of making decisions for him or herself. So the parent makes those decisions for the kid. But the whole purpose of parenting is clearly to put an end to that situation. In other words, parents, if they're good parents, try to raise kids to the point where they are capable of making their own decisions. And if you have a father or a mother who wants to decide for you in your 20s and 30s and 40s, then you've got a lousy parent, right? In other words, the purpose of parenting is to put an end to childishness by getting the kid to what we now call the age of reason. The problem with the doctrine of the good king is that the good king never gets his subjects to the position of the mature kid. In other words, the good king always wants to be making decisions on behalf and in the interests of his subjects. But that treats adults as perpetual children. You know, what defines an adult is the ability to run your own life by virtue of your own insights. In other words, what defines adulthood is possession of reason, the ability to conduct life rationally. And by the way, we have all kinds of exceptions to this, even among physiological adults. I mean, for example, someone who is not in possession of their reason, as we say, you can go and get a court order which gives you as a relative or a spouse or whatnot the, what's the name of the, what am I thinking of here, the right of attorney. In other words, you can make their decisions for them if they don't possess reason. So even in our current law, we recognize that independent adulthood involves the ability to conduct one's life rationally. What Kant says is that he is now living through a period in the mid-1700s in which the European population, anyway, is throwing off the bonds, the chains of its perpetual childhood. In other words, the species is achieving collective adulthood. Politically, the way it does that is by replacing monarchies with republics. Kant was a republican in the classical sense of the word. Kant saw two great republics in the process of creation during his own period, the United States of America and France. And both of those acts of creation were the result of revolutions. The American Revolution and the French Revolution were both supported by Kant, although Kant backed away from the French Revolution when the so-called terror, the beheadings of political opponents, became widespread. For Kant, the replacement of monarchies with republics is the replacement of perpetual children with adults capable of ruling themselves. And the whole idea of a republic is that of a government by the consent of the governed. Government by the consent of the governed. In order to give consent, even in law, you must be an adult. Now, kids can't sign contracts. They can't give their consent, but adults can. The notion that government must be by consent of the governed means that government is the self-government of rational adults. And so for Kant, the transition to republics, which was beginning during his own period of time, was a major step forward in the general process of enlightenment. Dare to use your own reason. You know, by the way, Kant did not think that lack of enlightenment was simply the result of the machinations of kings and priests. Sometimes people prefer to be unenlightened. Sometimes people prefer to have their decisions made for them. And if you have to decide for yourself, well, there's a certain amount of anxiety involved with that. Right? You know, you have to exhibit some degree of courage to achieve the position, you know, of independent, rational adulthood. You know, if your spouse is making your decisions for you, or your parents, or your parish priest, life is at least easier, you know, presuming that they're not tyrants, right? Life is at least easier than when you have to make your decisions for yourself. So for Kant, the achievement of enlightenment involved, first of all, the cultivation of the courage necessary to become an adult. I've been talking about politics here. There's another aspect to this, too, because the unenlightened period, according to the theorists of the Enlightenment that precedes Kant's age, is a period in which kings rule politically and priests dominate culturally. Now, what does this mean? What this means is that, to be blunt, you know, the Catholic Church is the dominant cultural institution. And the Catholic Church dominates by authority, ultimately the authority that Catholics believe the Pope received from St. Peter, who got it from Christ, right? You know, there's the whole doctrine of papal infallibility. When the Pope speaks ex cathedra, the Pope is incapable of error. And so whatever the Pope says when the Pope speaks ex cathedra must be accepted by Catholics as the truth. That is, it's called in religion, dogma. You know, there's no missing words here. That is what is known as dogma. Any received teaching that cannot be questioned by the believer is dogma. Well, the priest is the local representative of dogma that must be simply accepted by the believer. In other words, the purpose of the priest is to do your thinking for you, if you are, as they say, a good Catholic. The purpose of the priest is to do your thinking for you. To some extent, you know, Martin Luther and the Reformation reacted against this, but very rapidly the Protestant sects also began to do their thinking for people. The Bible cannot be challenged. Every word that's written here is literally true, and I happen to be the one who can tell you what these words mean. Right? This is a Protestant view, at least a view on the part of fundamentalist Protestants. And so when you have a priest or a minister who does your thinking for you, you are once again kept in the condition of a child. An adult does his or her thinking for his or herself. So when reason is liberated, childhood is left behind and rational adulthood is entered. And this is the primary significance of the Enlightenment, according to Kant. It's not an easy thing. It's a process that was in play during Kant's own period. It wasn't clear who was going to win. I mean, after all, when the American and the French revolutions happened, there were probably two pre-existing republics in the world. And that's kind of stretching it. You know, one was Holland, and the other was perhaps Switzerland. four countries after the French Revolution in a world of, I don't know how many nations existed during that period of time, but certainly there were far more monarchies than there were republics, and a good portion of the population of the earth, and particularly the European population, lived under the authority of priests and other religious people, religious officials. So what Kant is describing is a movement that's just beginning in his time, but it's a movement that ultimately triumphed. And it's the movement that I think is really most centrally adequate to the modern age. In other words, what we have here is the real breakthrough to modernity. You know, the Renaissance is a first attempt that's as backward-looking as it is forward-looking. But the Enlightenment is completely forward-looking. Now, what can I say? A very important role is played in this whole process by science, by natural science. And I think you have to also take a look at the way our world differs from the world that preceded the modern period, and from still portions of the world that exist outside of the reach of the Enlightenment today. Science has come to play the cultural role that was once played by religion. And what I mean by this is not that science answers all the questions that religion raised. It doesn't. It usually just doesn't involve itself in those questions. You know, do people survive after death? Well, most neuroscientists will tell you privately that no, they don't. But they won't say it publicly, right? Especially because the Christian right is fairly influential legislatively in the United States. So if scientists want their money, their grant money, they keep quiet about that kind of thing. When I say that science has come to replace religion as the dominant cultural institution, what I mean is, look around you. Now, we have a college of science. We don't have a college of theological dogma. Where does the vast amount of public spending for the military, for research and development purposes go? It goes to the sciences. It doesn't go to the churches. Even in the United States, which is unusually religious, but certainly by European standards, that's the case. When kids go to school, they study the sciences. And there's, at least in the U.S., the doctrine of separation between church and state. They don't get religious instruction in the public schools. Science has come to replace religion as the dominant cultural institution. I mean, clearly, the impact on our lives is tremendous, You're using a computer there, I've got a cell phone in my pocket, the lights are on, I mean, all this is the result of the scientific revolution, which, by the way, began during the Renaissance, with the work of Galileo and Copernicus and Kepler, but really achieved its first full expression very shortly before Kant was born in the work of Isaac Newton, whose book, the book is called The Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy. It's interesting, Newton still calls physics natural philosophy. But Newton, more than anybody else, is responsible for the subsequent separation of science from philosophy. In other words, the divorce between science and philosophy. The two of them went their separate ways after Newton. And so what is science? What is science for Kant? What is science for the Europe of the 18th century? But the independent application of human reason to the understanding of the natural world. What Newton shows in that magnificent work where he uncovers the essential laws of motion, which he begins to explore, the basic natural laws that govern the cosmos, what he shows is that human reason, when applied to understanding nature, can generate knowledge which is then capable of being applied to changing things. Now, generations of engineers followed the prescriptions of Newton's physics. They still do. You don't need Einstein to send a rocket into space. All you need is Isaac Newton. You can plug Newton's laws of motion in and discuss and figure out, if you know the coefficient of gravity, which we do, you can figure out exactly how much of a much rocket fuel is necessary to impart sufficient momentum to a rocket to escape the gravitational pull of the Earth simply by using Newton's laws of motion. In other words, by taking this new rational science of nature and applying it, what you get is a world that is transformed by technology in the modern sense of the word. So there are really two things going on, you know, according to Kant during his period. There's an advance of political reason as monarchies are overthrown and replaced with republics, in particular in the case of the United States and France. And there is the triumph of natural science over religious dogma. But what that means ultimately is not only that people begin to think for themselves, but that the power of human beings to intervene in and transform the natural world increases dramatically. In other words, what we get here is the beginnings of modern technology. Okay. There's a problem, though, that Kant faces. And there's an irony. And the irony is that the very period in which this is happening is also a period of bloody war. Now, the two nations that are the most advanced outposts of the Enlightenment in Europe are the very nations that are killing one another on the battlefield in a struggle for global hegemony, France and England. In other words, Enlightenment is occurring at the same time that war is becoming a major problem. And Kant is far-seeing here, because Kant recognizes that technology does increase the human power to alter events. But technology, one of its primary applications, is the conduct of war. So Kant is not living, you know, during the nuclear age. You know, he's not living, even mechanized weaponry is still a little bit off. It's really the Civil War that's the first breakthrough to machine guns, you know, Gatling guns and things like that. But what Kant foresees is that as scientific knowledge increases, war will become more and more destructive until ultimately the prospect of, if not human annihilation, certainly human barbarism. In other words, the destruction of culture and the return to a violent and stupid mode of existence is certainly possible. And so what Kant wants to do in Perpetual Peace is ensure that the Enlightenment is capable of succeeding without leading to the destruction of the human species. And for him, that involves the obligation to put an end to war. I think it's an amazing fact that Kant, you know, foresaw this in the mid-1700s, because, you know, as I said, he wasn't around for machine guns. He wasn't around for chemical weapons, well, they're very rudimentary chemical weapons, but he wasn't around for anything like the nerve gas that was used in World War I or the biological weapons that are now available. He certainly wasn't around for atomic weaponry, and he didn't live through either of the world wars, and yet he foresaw in the trends of the mid-1700s the situation that we now face. So for Kant, and Kant has a very pithy way of putting it. You know, at the very beginning of Perpetual Peace, he talks about a sign that he's seen, and that other people have seen, on an inn. And the sign is a painting of a grave with the title Perpetual Peace on it. Well, what Kant points out is that that sign and that symbol are ambiguous. You know, they can mean one of two things. They can mean a condition in which people have put an end to war and so made perpetual enlightenment, in other words, perpetual progress possible. Or it can mean what he calls the peace of the mass grave. The peace of the mass grave. We have two versions of perpetual peace to choose between, according to Kant. An end to the practice of war or the peace of the mass grave. And those are the stakes that he foresees, as I said, in the middle of the 1700s. Now, Kant is also one of the great moral philosophers, one of the great moral philosophers in general of the 18th century and of the modern period as a whole. And for Kant, it's possible to derive in a very strict way our obligation to put an end to war from what he calls the basic principle of morality. Kant raises the following question. Let me ask you what you believe to be moral, right? And you say, well, helping other people when they're in distress is moral. Refraining from murder is moral. I don't know what else. You might tell me that you believe that participation in jihad is moral. You might tell me that the eradication of the racially inferior is moral. Yes.
Virtuous.
That's
moral.
Yeah. Well, what do you mean by virtuous, though?
I don't know. Just Google them.
Don't let Google do your thinking for you. That's as bad as a priest.
Dictionary.com. Up on the right conduct.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Right. Right conduct, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what is right conduct? Now, Kant's point is that plenty of people have views about what is moral. But how do we know that a candidate for a moral principle is actually a form of morality? In other words, I tell you that I believe that killing the racially inferior is moral. How do I know? How do I know to reject that, but to accept the principle that murder is immoral? How do I know that? How can I select between candidates for morality? How can I choose between all the things that people believe or assert to be moral? What Kant says is that we need something besides a particular moral principle. In other words, the principle thou shalt not kill is not going to help me decide whether or not it's okay to skip visiting your aunt when she's in the hospital because she drives you crazy, right? The principle that, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife is not going to help you decide whether or not you have an obligation to work to put an end to war. You see, these are all specific moral principles. What we want is something else, according to Kant. What we want is a supreme principle of morality, a principle that allows us to sift and choose between candidates for moral principle that would presumably allow in thou shalt not kill, but exclude thou shalt eliminate the racially inferior. Where do we get such a principle from? What is the basic principle of morality? Kant says, since we're not looking for a particular moral principle, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. I'm just going through the Ten Commandments because at least some of them are widely accepted, right? Since we cannot appeal to a particular moral principle, we need something that has no specific content. The supreme principle of morality is not going to tell us not to covet our neighbor's spouses or not to commit murder. It's those two
principles have specific content to them. You know, thou shalt not kill refers to the act of murder. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's spouse refers to the act of adultery. But the basic principle of morality is not going to refer to anything specific. It's not going to refer to murder. It's not going to refer to adultery, because it must exist with a different status. It's the principle that will allow us to select between concrete candidates for moral principle. It can have no content. It must be, Kant tells us, completely formal in character. There's a distinction in general, in philosophy, also in art, by the way, between form and content. The supreme principle of morality can have no content if it is actually going to act the way we want it to. It can have only form. And so what is the form of the supreme moral principle? Kant calls the supreme moral principle the categorical imperative. The categorical imperative. And he expresses it in four different ways. Let me just, I wish I could write this on the board, but I can't. Let me just give you the first formulation. First formulation of the categorical imperative is the following.
Categorical imperative.
An imperative is a statement that tells you to do something, right? If I say to you, the door is blue, that's a declarative sentence. If I say to you, is the door blue, that's an interrogative sentence. If I say to you, paint the door blue, that's an imperative sentence. An imperative sentence always involves some command. Do X is an imperative sentence. Right? That's an imperative. What's a categorical imperative? Well, Kant, this is a logical distinction, and the distinction is between conditional statements and statements that hold true without any conditions. If you want a pack of cigarettes, then go to the local convenience store. That's a conditional imperative. If you want a pack of cigarettes, then go to the local convenience store. But if I say to you, do X, and you say to me, why should I do it? And I reply to you, because you should, that is a categorical imperative. In other words, it does not rest on another conditioning clause. Not go to the store if you want cigarettes, but thou shalt not commit murder. Why? Because murder is opposed to what is categorically good. Now, what is categorically good? Kant says the only thing that's categorically good is a good will. The will for Kant is the way that we choose. Kant's a Stoic. Kant is an 18th century Stoic. Just as for the Stoics, the only thing that's unequivocally good is the human character, for Kant, the only thing that is unequivocally good is the choices that we make that determine our characters. That's a Stoic position. And he calls this the will. A will is categorically good that follows the categorical imperative. Now let me give you the imperative, okay? The first formulation. Act always in such a way that you can will that the maxim of your action is a universal law. Will in such a way that you can will that the maxim of your action hold as a universal law. I'll say it one more time, okay? Will in such a way that you can will that the maxim of your action hold as a universal law. That has no content to it. It doesn't refer to murder, it doesn't refer to adultery, it doesn't refer to anything. It's a completely formal principle.
Kant tells us that the supreme principle of morality has to be completely formal. But what is the form here? The form is, I'll say it again, right? Will in such a way that you can will that the maxim of your action hold as a universal law. The maxim of your action is the principle upon which you act. Yeah, it's very simple. It's the principle upon which you act. Will in such a way that the principle upon which you act can hold as a universal law. The form of the categorical imperative is that of universalizability. Moral actions are actions that are universalizable. They're actions that can hold as universal laws, or the principles behind them are principles that can hold as universal laws. It's okay to steal if you really need something. Or it's okay to steal if you really like something. Right? And I see that, is that a cell phone back there?
Yeah.
Boy, that's really cute. I really would like to have that, you know? I'm sure you'll be able to get another one. Somebody will give you another cell phone sometime. So you leave the room, and I really like that cell phone, and so I meander over to it, and I put it in my pocket, and I go home with it. Why is that wrong? Why is that wrong? Kant says, to determine whether it's right or wrong, ask yourself the following question. Can the principle behind that action be universalized? What does he mean by that? What does he mean by the principle holding as a universal law? When I want something really badly, it's okay for me to steal it. How do I universalize that? That's the principle. That's
what
the next.
What if someone did it to you?
Say it again?
If someone did it to you?
Well, universalize it for me. When I want something really badly, it's okay for me to steal it. Let's universalize the sentence, yeah.
Every single time you desire something, it's right for you to steal it.
For me?
For everybody.
For
anybody.
Whenever anybody wants something really badly, it's all right for them to steal it. That's the universalized version. Whenever I want something really badly, it's all right for me to steal it. That's a particular statement about me. The universal statement is that whenever anybody wants something badly, it's okay for them to steal it. Let's say that we universalize this principle. We now all live by that principle. What's wrong with that? What's the problem with that?
None of us would have anything.
Go ahead, say it.
Well, I just said everything. But we'd
be
robbing each other.
Pardon me?
We'd just be robbing each other.
And so what would that mean? So we all rob one another.
Maybe kill each other?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that might be a concrete consequence. But what's the problem? Think about just the principle. Whenever somebody wants something badly, it's okay for them to steal it.
What if they can get it?
Watch them like others. Whenever they want to and are able to, it's okay for them to steal it. What's the problem with that universalized version? Yeah.
Well, if you want something, you can just go out and steal it. There's no purpose to even work for anything. So.
Yes, the problem here is that the whole practice of owning things goes out the window. If it's okay for anybody to steal what they want, then nobody is capable of owning anything. And I turn my back and you take my umbrella. You turn your back and I take your cell phone. You don't own that cell phone. I don't own that umbrella. The whole practice of ownership comes to an end. See, what Kant says is, what I really want is the non-universalized version of this. I want to be able to steal when I want something, but I don't want you to be able to steal when you want something. I want private property in place for you, but not for me. I want you to respect my property while I let myself off the hook by giving myself permission to steal your stuff whenever I want to. The essence of immorality, according to Kant, is that we make an exception in our own case. The essence of immorality is non-universalizability, which simply means that I make an exception in my own case. What I really want is for you all to respect the rules, but for me to be able to violate them. Look, I kind of like you. You seem like a very nice person. But after all, you're not me. I mean, owning that cell phone can't possibly be as important to you as it would be for me to own it, because I'm special. You know? I'm special. I'm different than you. Now, I'm the one who really counts in the universe. See, what I'm doing is I'm making an exception in my own case. I want you to respect what I own, but I don't want to be subject to the obligation of respecting what you own. The essence of immorality is the logic of the exception. Why do we make exceptions in our own case? People do it all the time, by the way, right? People cheat on their taxes, right?
Yeah.
I mean, who the hell hasn't cheated on their taxes? You haven't cheated on your taxes? You're so full of shit. this is a cop. I mean, he's not going to admit to anything. Everybody cheats on their taxes, but the problem is that what we want is everybody to pay their taxes so that we can cheat on them. If everybody cheats on their taxes, then everybody's tax bill goes up. They have to raise more taxes, right? So, you know, you can cheat, but you're going to be cheating on a higher tax level. So what we really would like is for everybody else to pay taxes while we're able to cheat. Right? I mean, that's what we're after. What we're after is an exception in our own case. There's a great moral experiment that Plato does in the Republic. He says, he talks about a myth, and the myth is the Ring of Gyges. The Ring of Gyges is a ring with a gem in it. And if you turn if you have the gem facing outward, nothing happens. But if you turn the gem toward the inside of your palm, you become invisible. You become invisible. Now, what Plato says is, if you are wearing the Ring of Gyges, why should you refrain from stealing, from murdering, from violating people's privacy? You see, morality has to answer that question. Now, most of us don't steal and don't, you know, violate privacy and don't murder because the gem is on the outside. You know, I mean, after all, it's a real risk. I mean, this guy's going to come right after you, right? Right? It's a risk. But with the Ring of Gyges, if there are no consequences for those actions, why ought you still not to engage in them? That's what morality has to answer. That's what moral philosophy has to answer. Why is it unjust to kill even if you are never caught? I'll go one further. Why is it unjust to kill even if people will continue for the rest of your life to believe that you are the greatest person in the world? You know the serial killers, I was going to kick out of this. When they catch a serial killer, they always ask the neighbors about the person. And the neighbors should always say, he's a great guy. I don't know what happened, right? You know, why is it wrong to do these things even if there are no negative consequences? See, you need a theory of morality that goes beyond the pragmatic here. And Kant claims to give it to us. The reason why it's wrong to do these things is it makes an exception in your own case. It cuts you off from the rest of humanity. The essence of the moral point of view is that you regard yourself as no more and no less important than anybody else. The essence of morality is that you regard yourself as no more and no less important than anybody else. What lures people away from that
what lures them into making an exception in their own case is what Kant calls self-love. You know, that's what makes me say, you know, you can't possibly want this as much as I do. It can't possibly be as useful to you as it is to me because I am special, right? But you see, when I said that, I've separated myself from everyone else. I made a special exception in my own case. The reverse way of saying this is to say that the essence of morality is that I am part of a universal moral community. And we should recognize this also from Stoicism, because the idea that we are all part of a universal moral community is what? What do the Stoics call that? All human beings are part of a universal moral community. What's the name for this in Stoicism? I don't care what you've written on your papers. I'm flunking everybody in the quiz.
Logos.
Say it again?
Logos.
Close, but not quite. You don't know? No? I've discussed it with all of you. That's it. I've had it. Nobody knows this? Google it. Stoics. Universal moral community. What do they call it? Universal moral community. We are all members of the universal moral community. We are all God's children. What is the name for this? Oh, God. Oh, should all be ashamed of yourself. Go and come back with the answer. Don't come back until you have the answer. Let's take a 10-minute break. No, I'm not talking to you. I'm pissed off. Get out of here and come back with the answer. Go find it somewhere.
I went to print out the midterm.
Yeah, I don't care about that. Go find out what the name of the Stoic concept is for a universal world.
Okay.
And then come back and talk to me about your paper. What?
No.
You have the answer to the question? No, then forget it.
The golden rule.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Can I get a day extension?
Say it again?
Can I get a day extension?
A day extension. Yes.
Okay. Should I email it to you or bring it to you?
I'll give you a week extension. How about that? Yeah, 1 week, okay? So bring it in the hard copy for me.
Okay.
Okay? Cool. He's a new father, you know? I'm amazed that he's able to drag himself in. So you're working a full shift?
Yeah.
Like 40 hours? You're working a 40-hour week.
Yep.
You've got a new baby, and you're coming to college? Insane. Walker, you really don't know the answer to this question?
I don't have it.
Unless I know it, I don't know.
Yeah, you will know it when I say it, for sure.
The idea that everybody...
You will know it when I say it, and that's for sure.
Why do you think that I should know it?
Because I asked about it in one of the questions. If you wrote the exam, you have written on the topic. That's why I'm going to kill everybody in this classroom. I'm making an exception for everybody. Say it again?
Did you define it differently on the exam?
Empire.
No, it's not empire.
I have the question here.
Wait, what was the question? I don't really get it.
What is the Stoic word for the universal moral community?
I don't like the
Say it again?
Cosmos.
Yes. Cosmopolitan.
Oh, cosmopolitan.
Yes, the Stoics are cosmopolitans.
We didn't get it.
Huh?
I didn't get it.
You didn't get what a cosmopolitan is?
Well, you were asking.
Oh.
I knew that.
Wait.
Well, wait a minute. How could you know that if you didn't get what I was asking? Because the idea of cosmopolitanism is that people are connected to one another as people, rather than as, you know, fellow Americans, fellow, you know, whatever, right? Whatever particular identity they happen to have. In other words, there are no exceptions. The moral laws pertain to the whole of rational creation. And that's the Kantian position, right? Kant is an 18th century version. Oh, sure.
Like, did anybody say, like, who are you to say what's moral, what's not?
Well, you see, it's not enough to say who is Kant. What you have to do is attack the principle. In other words...
But even the whole universal law thing, like, who's to say what's the universal law?
But what Kant is saying is that in logic, there's the concept of what sometimes called a tautology. A tautology is just a restatement of the meaning of a word. You see, universal means pertaining to everyone, right? So, I mean, you can't have a universality that has an exception, you know? Because that's what universal means. So, in other words, you can't have a parent who's never had a child, right? You could say, well, who are you to say that? Well, that's what parenthood means. Parenthood only makes sense in relation to children. Universalizability or universality only makes sense when you say that there is no exception. And what Kant is saying is that it's only that how can I put it? Give me another candidate for morality. Give me another candidate for morality. Got one?
Another candidate?
Yeah. What do you think is moral? What do you think that makes something moral? You think it's the fact that you believe it to be moral?
Just as well with Jesus.
I think a lot of people do something because he will say it's moral.
Oh, sure.
But not because they think it is.
Absolutely. Sure.
People have different ideas of what's moral, what's wrong.
Absolutely. And most people in a whole bunch of registers simply believe what they were taught, or what their friends believe, or what their parents believe. You know, they never question it. But of course, that's not rational, right?
Yeah.
So what Kant is saying is that if you have any commitment to rationality at all, then this is what you will. This is the position you will ultimately arrive at. Of course, if you're not rational, there's nothing that Kant or anybody else can do. Right? You can say, I don't care. The Aryan race is superior. What's your argument for that? Well, fuck yourself, right? That's what the Nazi would reply, but that's not a rational position, right? In other words, a commitment to rationality, Kant says, ends up with an understanding that the categorical imperative is correct. So you could also say that the reason why...
With the Nazis, they had like a moral, like, for them it was just what they were doing was...
Yeah, for them, the racially inferior were infections that had to be wiped out. What Kant would say, though, is that this is an irrational position.
Yeah, but why is it irrational to them? It was irrational.
She got it.
Well, let me put it this way. Is the world flat or not?
Yeah.
So people who think that the world is flat are wrong?
Yeah.
Even though to them they believe that the world is flat?
Yeah, but that's proven, so you can't believe it.
Well, how is it
proven? You believe it?
You believe it?
Oh, Sean, show. How is it proven?
Science has proved it.
So you're putting your faith in a rational procedure, right? In science. You put your faith in a rational procedure of science. Why don't you put similar faith in a rational procedure of morality? Well, you have to be able to answer that question if you think that there's a difference, right? See, what Kant is saying is that there's really no fundamental difference. You believe that the world is round. Well, the reason why you believe it is that...
Because you're foolish.
We have
the world's flat.
Well, we have photographs.
You have two feet.
You have to be able to read those photographs.
You've got two-dimensional photographs.
Yes, two-dimensional photographs. Even if you have a three-dimensional hologram of there, what difference does that make, right? You have to have a theory of the way light works, of you know why it is that the image of a round Earth is correct, and so forth. Okay, you've redeemed yourself. And you see, what that does, what that commits you to is a whole bunch of rational procedures. So if you're not willing to say, whoever believes the Earth is flat, it's flat for them, then you should not be willing to say that whoever believes that you know such and such is good, it's good for them. It's just that you have a different set of rational procedures. And for Kant, ultimately, they're summed up by the categorical imperative.
If it has the power.
Yeah.
Professor, in Kantian ethics, this is Kantian ethics.
This is Kantian ethics, yeah.
But how does this relate to perpetual time?
I'll get there.
Oh, okay. But right now we're just going through...
Let me go through the second. Let's do the second formulation of the categorical imperative. The first one is this, right? Act always...
I'm making a classroom shank. My friend ripped the top of my pen off, and I'm trying to like get smooth. Don't worry about it. It makes sense to me.
That's what matters.
Yes.
This is the first formulation of the categorical imperative. Act always in such a way that you can hold that the maxim, that you can will that the maxim of your action holds as a universal law. The maxim of your action holds as a universal law. There's a second formulation. Kant says it's identical with the first. In other words, it's completely convertible, the first, without any loss of meaning. And it's this. Act always in such a way. That you treat humanity whether in your own person or that of another. Always as an end. And never as a means merely. Okay, step audience. Act always in such a way that you treat humanity, whether in your own person or that of another, always as an end and never as a means merely. What does it mean to treat somebody as a means? Yeah, use them to realize some other purpose. Another word for means might be instrument. Aristotle says that Aristotle accepted slavery. And in the Politics, Aristotle says the slave is a living tool. In other words, the slave's interests don't count. The slave is simply a tool that's used by his owner in order to achieve an external end, whether it's producing crops or whatever it happens to be, right? Cleaning the house, whatever it happens to be. To treat someone as a means is to treat them as an instrument for the realization of your own purposes. Now notice that Kant does not say, don't treat people as means. What he says is, don't treat people as means merely. Why? You know? Why is it unavoidable for us to treat people as means?
Even though, you know, as slaves, workers, work under a boss or a lord, under a means for them.
Sure. Oh, sure, yeah. You go to the cafeteria and buy a slice of pizza. You help hand money to the person at the register. You are treating that person as a means to your end. And you end up getting a piece of pizza. Right? They have to perform the financial transaction using the register. Or that person is treating you as a means to an end. You end up getting paid. You're treating one another as means. But you do not go up to the person and give them a swift kick.
I have.
Sean, you're a reprobate. You're hopeless. There's no way to save you. I can tell that right now. Look, this desk is a means, and it's a means that helps me sit or whatnot. But I can go up this way. And nobody winces, nobody thinks. You might think that I'm crazy, but you don't think what a bastard that guy is.
It's fun to do it to the lunch lady.
Say it again.
I said it's fun to do that to the lunch lady.
This I'm just joking. Is appropriately treated as a means merely. All it is a means. The person at the register is not a means merely. What that means is she or he has interests of their own. They count. They count. They demand as human beings an attitude on our part, not only of use, right? We use them when we buy something from them, but of respect. They are, in Kant's language, not things, but persons. See, a thing can be used as a means merely. A thing has no interests of its own. If I take this from you, I'm really fixated on the Samsung, and I smash it against the wall, the reason why it's bad for me to do that is that I've negatively impacted on your interests. The phone itself has none. The phone is a thing. You're a person. It's possible to treat people disrespectfully, but it's not possible to treat things disrespectfully. Things are there to be used. People must be respected, even if it's necessary to use them. This is what he means by saying that you need to treat others not as a means merely. An end, what is he getting at here? Treat them as an end and not a means merely. We contrast means and ends, right? You know, if I buy a hammer, I might buy that as a means to the end of repairing my front door. Right? And why do I want to repair my front door? Well, I want to repair my front door because I need to use it to get in and out of my house. Why do I want to get in and out of my house? Well, the house is necessary in order to shelter me. See, what I'm doing here is I'm tracing a succession of means to ends beyond those means. So the hammer is a means to repairing the door. A door is the means to getting in and out of the house. The house is a means to shelter. Each of these ends are not. How can I put it? They're not ends in themselves. They are means to further ends. What does it mean to be an end in oneself? Think about it. Walker, I am obligated to treat you, or better, as Kant says, I'm obligated to treat humanity in your person as an end. What does that mean?
That I'm already a final product.
Something. Yeah. There's nothing beyond you. There's nothing beyond you that can justify
my callous use of you.
As a Maoist, I disagree.
And why do you disagree?
Because the end justifies the means.
The end justifies the means. It's true. The end might justify the means, but the problem is that most people who have acted on that precept have ended up with ends that were very bad. So if you could end up with a good end, that might justify the means. But what is a good end? But what is that a good end?
Just
what is that a good end for? You know, any end that you name has got to involve some reference to people and the interests of people and the thriving of those people. You know, you might want to create a revolution, you might want to overturn the existing social order, but why? Just because it's fun to do so? You know, because it'll piss your parents off? If you're serious about it, you want to do it because the result is a better way for people to live. But what's a better way for people to live? It's a way in which people are able to express their humanity more fully. In other words, it's a society in which people are treated as ends rather than as means. You get back to the Kantian definition here. Act always in such a way that you treat humanity, whether in your own person or that of another. You are obligated, according to Kant, not only to respect other people, but to respect yourself. You have a positive moral obligation to yourself. This, I think, is interesting because we generally think of moral obligations as obligations to other people. You have an obligation to take care of your parents. You have an obligation to help someone who has fallen in the street, that sort of thing. But what Kant is saying is that if you have such an obligation to other people, then you must also have such an obligation to yourself, because after all, you are a person as well. What would it mean to fail in that regard? In other words, what would it mean to treat humanity in your own person as a means mirror? How would you do that? What would an example of that be?
I think you wouldn't care about anybody's feelings as long as you get
what you want. But here we're talking about an obligation to yourself rather than to other people. In other words, we're not talking, of course, we have an obligation to other people. But the issue now is that in addition to having an obligation to other people, you have an obligation to yourself. How would you violate such an obligation? See what I'm saying?
Some acts of like religion where you self-sacrifice that.
Well, that's interesting.
Or some people ask you to basically hit yourself.
Yeah, oh, masochism. What's the problem with masochism? Is that you're hitting yourself or what?
I'm not really sure. I don't really know if that's the right word.
You're getting there. I mean, I think you're coming real close. The example I like to use is that of a heroin addict. Now, what is a heroin addict doing? A heroin addict is injecting heroin in order to experience a state of temporary bliss, right? But of course, there are all kinds of drawbacks in general to the use of heroin. People become addicted, their life becomes focused on the acquisition of the drug, and so on and so forth. They generally don't develop talents, they'd rather simply bliss out, that kind of thing. If you are a heroin addict, what you are doing is you are treating humanity in your own person as a means to an external end. What's the external end? The experience of bliss. See, no experience of bliss can be as valuable as you yourself are as a human being. Kant says, if you don't develop your talents, for example, let's say that you're just, you know, it's just a real lazy bastard, right? Well, you could talk about not meeting your obligations to other people and not making money to take care of your family and so forth. That might all be true. But Kant's additional point is, you fail in an obligation to yourself. You are obliged to yourself. You have an obligation to yourself to develop your talents. Otherwise, you're just treating yourself like
a body that experiences certain pleasurable things, right? You know, you like to lie down and just feel the lethargy taking you over. So that treats humanity in your own person as nothing but a machine for producing that feeling. You have a higher status in the universe. And that higher status comes from the fact that you are a rational being. See, what connects people with one another, Kant says, treat humanity. But he's not using the word humanity as a species concept. See, the reason why we have a moral connection to one another is not that we're members of the same species. That's no more significant than having the same skin color, or having the same gender, or speaking the same language. All of that's just contingent. What Kant means when he says, treat humanity in your own person or that of another always as an end, is treat the fact that you are a rational agent. What connects us with one another in a universal moral community is the possession of rationality. We are connected morally because we're capable of treating one another as ends in ourselves. Now you can say, don't we have a moral connection with animals? This is a tough one, right? Strictly speaking, for a Kantian, you don't. An animal is not a rational being. Some Kantians, I think probably without Kant's backing, would say that you have a rational connection with a moral connection with animals, but it's a one-way connection. You know, you're there, you take care of them, right? Your job is to take care of them. They're like children who never grow up, right? They are beings who are never capable of achieving rationality. And so your relationships with them will never be reciprocal. They will only run in one direction. So people who argue that there are obligations to your pets will say, yeah, but it's not like the obligation that you have to other people. Other people are capable of fully reciprocal relations with you. You know, just as I treat you as a person, you're capable of treating me as a person. And that is what establishes a connection between us that is a moral connection in the genuine sense of the word. So you see, the issue about the Nazis is, were the Jews and the Gypsies really nothing more than a viral infection? That's what they're claiming, right? But you see, the claim there is they do not possess what makes people a part of a universal community. They don't possess reason, Kant says. But that's a testable claim. You can enter into a conversation with a Gypsy or a Jew, and you can come to the conclusion very quickly that, like you, they possess reason. In which case, the Nazi position is just wrong. They're straightforwardly wrong in the same way that the person who thinks that the Earth is flat rather than round is straightforwardly wrong. Act always in such a way that you treat humanity, whether in your own person or that of another, always as an end and never as a means merely. Think about war. What happens in war?
People die.
People die. Yeah, but people die in people die in, of course, the day in Boston anyway. But what happens in war? People die in each other's hands, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
People as means.
Yeah. War is the most massive treatment of people as means merely. You know, the enemy soldier, you shoot the enemy soldier because the enemy soldier is an obstacle to achieving your end. The end might be occupying a field or taking a position somewhere, you know, advancing your troops or whatnot. You shoot the enemy soldier because the enemy soldier is an obstacle to achieving your end. And the killing of the enemy soldier is a means to the achievement of your end. you kill the enemy soldier by completely disregarding the personhood of the enemy soldier. Kant goes further than that, by the way. It's very interesting because in Perpetual Peace, Kant says that you treat your own soldiers as means merely by turning them into killing machines. In other words, you do not respect the moral autonomy, the personhood of your own soldier when you turn them into a machine for killing other people. You use them as means merely. It's very interesting, you know, when you think about basic training. Has anybody been in the military? Yeah, you went through basic training? What branch of the military?
Army.
You went through Army basic training. So you had a sergeant and the whole bit, right?
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit what that was like? Is it like the way the films portray it?
It's not. The films will let you know everything is cool, you know, and high stuff, but when you go through training, it's like 24 hours, and mentally and physically. You have to train, you have to do the same thing over and over again, so when you do it, it's like second nature to you.
Right. And what is the
there's a chain of command, of course.
Right, sure. But is the drill sergeant abusive?
They're not physically abusive, but they will come close to you to see how far they will take you.
Verbal, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And what's the purpose of that?
I think just to see if you could buckle under pressure, you know. If you go in a war and it's people yelling, guns fired, and you have a mission ahead of you, you don't want anything else to sway you from your mission.
So is the point then to test whether or not or to develop in people the capacity to follow orders?
That also, yeah. I mean, it's that's why we have chain of command.
Right. To follow orders in intense situations.
Yes.
Situations where it's difficult to do it.
Yes, you can't question in order to shoot somebody who will get it.
You can't question an order. So the idea then is to take away the independent rational capacity of the soldier, right?
Of course, yes.
And to make the soldier into an instrument.
Yes.
And of course, Kant's point is that treats humanity, in the case of the soldier, as a means merely. Now, the rules of engagement are interesting because, I'm sure you know this, you are obligated, the army will tell you, to refuse to follow certain orders. You know, if your commanding officer orders you to kill unarmed civilians, it does not get you off the hook in court to say, I was just following orders. There's a history behind this, right? And the history is the Nuremberg Trials. When the Nazis were tried at Nuremberg, and these were not foot soldiers, usually it's the foot soldier who gets the brunt of these things, right? But in the case of the Nazi trials, it was the generals,
the higher ups,
right? What they often said was, well, you cannot hold us responsible for such and such a crime because we were just following orders. And the Nuremberg Doctrine that came out of that, Nuremberg was a tribunal that was set up by the French, the English, the Americans, and the Russians to try the Nazis. The Nuremberg Doctrine says that I was just following orders is not a valid excuse. And so in the Army Rules of Engagement, what it says is you are obligated to follow all lawful orders. But of course, how much did they drill that into you when you were in basic training?
Very much.
Did they?
Yeah.
No kidding. That's interesting.
It was such a big thing for Rule of Engagement for, oh, you're not supposed to shoot at somebody.
That's interesting. Because there were cases both in Vietnam and then in the Iraq War of soldiers who massacred civilians, and then the excuse was I was just following orders, and the Army prosecutes the soldier and so forth. So there's been a heightened awareness of this.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. It wasn't the case in Vietnam. I mean, the drill sergeants didn't, I don't think even mentioned the number of rules. But I think there is a heightened sensitivity now in the American Army. Yeah, there certainly seems to be in Afghanistan in particular, where the emphasis is on, as they used to say in Vietnam, winning hearts and minds. So they want the American soldiers to appear not as as threats to the civilian population, but as...
Well, after that fiasco with the prisoners.
With Abu Ghraib, yeah, right. So there has been some analysis. That's interesting. Okay. Let me just reiterate this position, the whole position of universalizability, the notion that you should treat humanity as an end and not merely as a means, is Kant's version of cosmopolitanism. And it's very similar to the Stoic conception, because remember, the Stoics said we are all members of a universal moral community. Oh, well, thank you very much. Yeah, that's great. You guys should all get credit for being here. Thank you. I forgot. The Stoics said we're all members of a universal community, moral community, because we all have a spark of God within us. What they meant by a spark of God was we all have reason. We all possess reason. We all possess the logos, to use your word, right? And that's why I said you were close, because to be a member of the cosmopolitan community means to share the logos, to share rationality, to be able to engage in conversation with one another in which we put forward positions and then defend them against criticism, if we try to reach agreements, if you want to communicate in some way that's significant, that isn't me just saying, you better believe what I'm telling you, right? That's what rationality is. That spark of rationality is what makes people members of the cosmopolis for the Stoics. Well, for Kant, that spark of rationality is what makes us all members of a universal community bound together by the categorical imperative. The categorical imperative is an obligation that holds whether or not anybody acts on it. We might all violate the categorical imperative, and we would still be members of a universal moral community. And the reason why, according to Kant, is that we would ultimately, the fact that we had violated it would register with us. And how would it register? And presuming that you're not a complete psychopath. I watched a remake of Halloween last night. Anybody see that? Terrible. This is the John Carpenter film about the guy who slashes everybody. So they made a remake of the thing, right? And he's, and what's his name? Michael, I guess, is the name of the villain. He's a psychopath, right? To use the old language. They're not called sociopaths. Somebody without a conscience. Well, presuming you're not a psychopath, if you violate the categorical imperative, that registers with you. And how does it register? You kill somebody. What's the Dostoevsky story? About, or the Poe story, about the telltale heart. You know, somebody's murdered, in Dostoevsky, they murder a landlady, or he murders, the guy murders a landlady. In Poe's story, I forget who's murdered. But what happens in Poe's story? You were shaking your head, do you remember?
I just remember from the Simpsons, actually, is
the telltale heart. So
I think he kills the landlord and puts the heart underneath the slated wood and then keeps beating.
What happens is the murderer hears the heart beating. But there's no physical heart beating, the person is dead. So, and finally, you know, as the murderer hears the heart beat again and again and again, the person is driven to tear the floorboard up and confess to his crime. He's killed someone, but he's unable to keep quiet about it. So what's the telltale heart? What does he fear?
His conscience.
I mean, it's Poe's way of concretizing the conscience. If you're not a psychopath and you violate the categorical imperative in any kind of major way, you will feel a pang of conscience. And you see, the fact that you're capable of feeling a pang of conscience connects you into the universal community. Even if everybody is treating each other very shabbily, the fact that people feel bad about it means that they have another status. They have a status as a member of what Kant calls the kingdom of ends. The kingdom of ends. The kingdom of ends is the ideal community in which everybody treats one another with respect. Kant doesn't say that, that it's possible to achieve it, right? But it is an ideal that continues to motivate people, even if only in the negative form of the pang of conscience. You know, you stole that from her and you now realize that it meant something to her.
You stole it.
No, you did. I saw you. You stole it from her and you begin to feel a pang of conscience about it. Right? That connect, that means that you have your place in the kingdom of ends, even if you're a real son of a bitch. As long as you're not a psychopath. A psychopath is presumably somebody who lacks minimum mental equipment to be considered a part of the universal community, which is why it's so difficult to deal with psychopaths. What do you do? I've never really understood it. Right? It's a fascinating case. I had a colleague who taught a course in serial killers, and it scared the hell out of me. But the serial killers are fascinating. I don't get it. So I guess, I mean, there's something, there's like an ultimate barrier there that I can understand killing somebody. I can understand having a reason for killing somebody. But the thing about serial killer is that they have no reason. You know, the act of murder is in essence done for its own sake.
They do for
it. Is that what it is?
Well, they don't have a reason. It's just they don't often have a reason for the particular person.
But what's the reason?
Well,
isn't it to reach a list just like the crack? Right.
Often it's to get off, like to use some drugs.
So there's a feeling of kind of like a power trip, an ultimate power trip.
An adrenaline rush,
a rush
involved.
Release
of endorphins.
Yeah? Maybe I should try it. I didn't realize that it was so pleasant. okay. In Perpetual Peace, Kant's going to argue that the biggest violator of the categorical imperative is the practice of war. What this means is that we have an obligation to end war, but on one additional condition, namely that it's possible to end war. If I tell you you have an obligation to levitate right now above your chair, clearly you don't have such an obligation. And even if levitating right now above your chair would save, you know, 10,000 human lives, you have no obligation to do it. Why not? You can't, right? You have no obligation to do something that's impossible. If it turns out that ending war is impossible, then clearly people do not have an obligation to work toward that. So what Kant has to show is two things. He wants to establish there's an obligation to contribute to the ending of war. He has to show, first of all, and it's fairly easy to show, that war violates the categorical imperative massively. And it does. Everybody agrees about that. But secondly, he has to show that it is possible to end war. And in order to do that, he has to counter a very widespread argument. And I've heard this time and time again. Why is it that some people argue it is impossible to end war? I've heard people argue this so many times. People who believe that it's impossible to end war, what do they say? Why is it impossible?
You mean like war in general?
Are you going to say something?
As long as we have like different countries that have different interests, so it's always going to be like conflicts.
That might be true. That's a rather sophisticated position. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think having an enemy in general unites people. If there's no enemy, that's just having that enemy going to war with another group of people brings unity to people that are going to war. So without that, I think that's one of the main reasons that people do go to war is just
to unify the local population.
It does unify them, yeah. For one common goal.
I see.
I think it's in our nature to them.
There we go. Why is it in our nature?
It's in our nature to them. We're all individual. We have our own way of looking at things.
Mm-hmm.
The next person doesn't have to have the same vision as you, so
sure.
You know, come to
the same. Why not arguments then?
Arguments are not going to, you know, you want to get what you want, so the ends to get what you want is to go to war.
I see. You're going to say
no.
Same thing? No?
Basically
the same.
I just think it's in not obviously not all cases, but in some cases it's necessary for you know, just like for moral reasons.
Okay, give me an example.
Like the Civil War to end
slavery. Yeah, yeah. Kant does not deny that given the practice of war, certain wars are moral.
Yeah.
But what he denies is that the general practice is moral. In other words, what he's saying is we're going to work to abolishing the practice. Not that if the practice is in place, certain acts of war are not called for. See what I'm saying? There's a distinction between those two things. So what he's really looking for is an end to the practice of war. And I think you're absolutely right. What did you mean?
David,
I think that you're absolutely right. I mean, the main argument that Kant has got to address is that it's in our nature, that war is in our nature. And there are different ways of putting it. You know, some people say, look, we have an aggressive impulse. It certainly seems like boys have an aggressive impulse. My wife is a clinical psychologist, and she's worked with a lot of kids, and she says that the only gender stereotype that seems to hold across cultures is that boys are more aggressive than girls. Young kids, they're more aggressive than girls. Whether that's cultural or biological, I don't know. But it does seem to be a part of the male stance to be aggressive. People are aggressive. People want what they want when they want it. People are incapable of treating each other simply as ends rather than as means merely. However you want to put it, human beings are descendants of the apes, you know, and some of the apes, and the apes practice, I don't know, chimpanzees hit each other over the head, you know, the chimpanzee trick, whatever it is, right? Whether it's a biological argument, an argument about instinct, an argument about, you know, people are incapable of, aggression is in our nature. Let's call this the realist position. Let's call this the realist argument against the possibility of ending war. Let's be realist about it. People are just too shitty. They're just real bastards when it comes down to this. At least in certain instances, and so we're not going to be able to end the war. The brilliant move that Kant makes in Perpetual Peace is he accepts that conception of human beings. See, it's often the case that pacifists will argue that that's a false conception of people. And actually, there are things that can be pointed to. There are cultures that don't have war. For example, the pygmies of the Uturo Forest. Have you ever read Colin Turnbull's classic anthropological work, The Forest People? The pygmies simply avoid conflict. You know, when they come in, when it looks like conflict is going to occur, they retreat into the forest. Of course, this assumes that there's forest to retreat into, and the forest is disappearing now. But there are cultures that just don't have war as a practice. So the argument then is, if there's even one culture that doesn't have war as a practice, then war cannot be in human nature because they are human and they don't engage in war. But Kant doesn't argue that way. You know, call that the idealist argument, right? Kant doesn't argue on idealist grounds. Kant accepts the pessimistic view of human nature, that the opponents of peace often, or at least the possibility of ending war, often refer to. And he says, yes, there is a bad streak in human beings. Ultimately, the bad streak is once again summed up by the idea of the principle of self-love. Whatever we say, whatever we give lip service to, we want what we want when we want it, right? And we make exceptions in our own case. We are given to self-love. We're given to seeing the world from our perspective and in the perspective of our interests and pursuing those interests. Kant says that's true.
with our people. Peace is still possible. Kant says that perpetual peace as a program must be such that even a race of devils would be capable of it, provided that the devils are rational. I'll say it again, perpetual peace as a program must be possible even if a race of devils were the ones that we were trying to implement a condition of peace among, provided that they are rational devils. What the path to peace is rational self-interest. Is rational self-interest. Ultimately, it's the realization that people don't get what they want through war. And in particular, as war becomes more destructive, as technology develops, when's the last time we ever got anything to worry after through war? Vietnam? Korea? Yeah, the U.S. has been involved in several wars since the Second World War, but as far as I can tell, they were either losses or draws. We've never achieved that. I can't see what we've achieved. So the notion is that rational self-interest should be enough to lead people to accept a framework of peace. Look at domestic society. Look at the society that you and I live in. Certainly there are lapses, right? There are criminals, there are acts of violence. But in general, relations between people in domestic society are peaceful ones. We live in a situation of civil peace. How did we get into that situation? Kant is a social contract theorist, like a number of modern thinkers. He is an inherent of social contract theory. Social contract theorists begin with, they begin by describing what they call the state of nature. The state of nature is the way human beings live without the benefit of government or law. Now, for some social contract theorists, this is actually an historical condition that preceded the rise of political and legal institutions. For other social contract theorists, it's simply a kind of thought experiment. Imagine that there were no laws and no governments. In such a condition, there is no such thing as, I should put it another way. In a state of nature, since there is no authority to settle disputes between people, the ultimate court of appeal is force. If without legal institutions and without governments, I have an argument with you, in the conventional sense of argument, not in the philosophical sense, I have a beef with you. And if it's sufficiently important to the concerns, land or property or whatever, a mate, then lacking a judge to go to, lacking a court to take you to, the only ultimate recourse I have is force. I can defend my interests and legitimately defend my interests through the application of violence. If there are no laws, violence is not unlawful. We all have interests, and it is natural for us to defend those interests aggressively. There's a problem, though, and the problem is this. If we are each defending our interests aggressively, if there are no courts to settle disputes, then we live a pretty precarious existence. John Hobbes was the Denzel Washington character in that movie about the demon that inhabits. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, Azazel, the demon?
Yes, yes, the demon that passes on from one person to another. It's a great film, by the way. It's really one of his best. But in any event, it's Thomas Hobbes. Thomas Hobbes, the British political philosopher who lived about 100 years before Kant, wrote a book called Leviathan. And Hobbes made the point that in the state of nature, with no courts, with no political institutions, where ultimately we are responsible for defending our own interests, and finally by defending them by force, Hobbes said, life in such a condition is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Human life in the state of nature, without laws, without courts, without political institutions, is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. It's solitary because ultimately the only person who is going to defend your interests is you. You are thrown back upon yourself in the state of nature. It's poor because lacking laws, there are no stable property institutions. You can defend what you are in the presence of. As soon as you leave, I grab the cell phone, and there's nothing to stop me. There are no laws making this yours. Nobody really owns anything except what they can carry with them and defend while they're young enough to do so. So life in the state of nature is not just solitary, it's poor. It's brutish because people are ultimately forced to do violence to one another. It's solitary. Solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. It's nasty, obviously, because people are not very nice to one another in the state of nature. And it's short. How long can you defend yourself against other people? Yeah, it's only when you're fairly young, right? As soon as old age begins to hit, you are everybody's target. Now, why do we leave the state of nature according to the social contract? We leave the state of nature, which is ultimately a state of violence, and we enter into a state of peace because it is in our rational self-interest to do so. You are better off in a society ruled by law, with courts and other institutions, than you are in the state of nature. So whatever your inclination to be aggressive is, your self-interest is to put that aggression behind you and to submit to public law. Hobbes says this is the transition from a state of war to a state of civil peace. Life, politically organized life under the rule of law, is civil peace. Life in the state of nature is the war of each against all. And each of us has a self-interest in putting an end to that. See, it doesn't matter what human nature is, as long as human beings are rational. If you are rational, you will see that your self-interest lies in living under law rather than living in a state in which you are ultimately able to defend your interests only through the application of violence. Given that, Kant says, the idea that people are incapable of peace has proven to be false. Because after all, we live in a state of peace, domestically. We live in a state of civil peace. What is possible domestically ought to be possible internationally as well. Because what happens here in the social contract idea is that each of us living in the state of nature recognizes that it is in our self-interest to leave the state of nature behind. And we sign, either figuratively or literally, a social contract. And the social contract says, that you give up your right to defend your own interests through force, and you give up that right in order to constitute a political authority that can govern you by the rule of law. We sign the contract because it's in our self-interest to do it. Once we've done that, we've created a state of civil peace in domestic society. But there is no such state of civil peace internationally. Internationally, every nation is in a state of nature with respect to every other nation. Internationally, ultimately, the way nations enforce their interests is through the application of violence. That's what war is. But if you were capable of leaving the state of nature and creating a state of civil peace within our own country, there is no reason in principle why we should be incapable of doing that internationally. We have to replicate what has happened within the confines of a nation state, but we have to do it among nations. And for Kant, as I said, if it can happen domestically, it can happen internationally. If it were really true that it is in our nature to be aggressive to such a degree that we are incapable of living peacefully with one another, then life in the United States or any other country would be impossible. Life under the rule of law would be impossible. But it's not impossible. It's happening, right? And the fact that it's happening means that it should be, in principle, capable of happening internationally. So what Kant has done is he's conceded the argument. In the state of nature, people are aggressive. Aggression might be a part of the human makeup. But luckily, self-interest trumps that. To be rational means that we can put our self-interest above our aggressive tendencies. We can live peacefully under the rule of law. Now, I'm going to stop here, but just to point ahead a little bit. Think about what Kant needs to do. Kant needs to come up with some international structure that does for nations what law in government does to the members of a national society. In other words, he has to come up with a structure that makes the transition from the state of war, not to the state of civil peace this time, but to the state of international peace. And that's what he attempts to do in Perpetual Peace. So read Perpetual Peace. If you've read it, read it again. It's a short work. And read the appendices, too, that I've included, okay? Because a lot of Kant's argumentation comes out in those. Okay, folks, we shall see you all next week. And anyway, don't forget to drop off your papers.
Okay? Some of the links in your website, like right after like the storage and stuff,
are expired.
Yeah.